This is a production of South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Turning on the internet so everything you say can and will be held against you. Welcome, DNR people, and look forward to your presentation today. Our pages aren't... Oh, we have a page. When you get the chance, come introduce yourself. You were here last week, weren't you?
No.
Oh, okay, you're new. You all look alike. Blue shirts all look alike. And... just a reminder, turn your cell phones to vibrate and or off, or you'll have to deliver a kolache to the committee next time. And I would ask the secretary to call the roll.
Representative Cronin.
Here.
Frerichs.
Here.
Hoffman.
Here.
Kopp. Olson.
Here.
Shrimp.
Here.
Sly.
Here.
Sorensen.
Yes.
Street.
Here.
Van Gerpen.
Here.
Verschio.
Here.
Bannerman.
Here.
Bruner.
Here. Quorum's present.
Yes.
Minutes of the last meeting. Everybody read and think they're great? Motion to approve. Second. By Shrimp. Motion by Street. Second by Shrimp. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion carried. Minutes are approved. If any of you guys have handouts, the pages will help you with that. And with that, the only thing on our agenda today is an overview from the DNR. And unless anybody has any questions, I'll turn it over to Secretary Perner to introduce his people and carry on. Just one request. As we get through the end, I know if we have questions or whatever, but, and I know your bills are starting in the Senate, maybe give us a little bit of an overview of what you have coming across and your fee increases and the absolute justification for such. So it'd be nice to hear it from you before we see it coming, and I think that'd be good for the committee. So
very good. So that's at the end of our presentation. So
yeah.
We worked that in a bit.
Yeah. Okay, great.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Steve Perner. I'm Secretary of the Department of Environment and Natural Resources. Just to give you a real quick thumbnail sketch of where I'm from, I'm originally from Rapid City, South Dakota. Graduated from the School of Mines and Technology with both a bachelor's and a master's degree in civil engineering. I've been with the department since 1979. In the department, we only have two divisions. We've got the Division of Financial and Technical Assistance and the Division of Environmental Services. We have both of those division directors here today, and I'll let them introduce themselves. Tim?
My name is Tim Fellis, Director of Environmental Services. Dave Templeton, Director of Financial and Technical Assistance.
And I think we also have our finance officer, Rob Green. And Joan Adonichek, our staff attorney, is one of the monitors in the rear of the room. Mr. Chairman, thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today. I thought what we'd do is kind of walk our way through this handout. This handout, we try to do two things. We try to, one, try to give you an overview of what we think the environmental condition of South Dakota is. And secondly, we try to give you a little understanding of what the Department of Environment and Natural Resources does in terms of trying to protect our environment. So if you go to slide three, we're going to talk about both land, water, and air. And we start out with land. We have three activities in the department that deal with protecting our land: solid waste disposal, mineral development, and spill cleanups. I'm proud to report to you that South Dakota is in full compliance with the federal solid waste rules. We have about 250 permitted solid waste disposal sites across the state. Most of those are relatively small and limited in what they can accept. We have 15 regional landfills, and the map on slide 5 shows the location of those regional landfills. Those, of course, can accept any and all municipal solid waste. All of those landfills, again, do comply with the federal solid waste rules. In terms of mineral development, we have almost 2,000 licensed sand and gravel sites, 71 producing gas wells, 103 producing oil wells, and 43 permits out there for gold, granite, and other minerals. In terms of trends, in terms of mineral development, slide 7 shows that the gold mining industry is in a declining trend. Wharf is still the only, gold mine that's in operation. In 2007, they produced over 57,000 ounces, so they're still doing pretty well. Homestake, of course, after 125 years of continuous operation, closed and is now being developed by the Science and Technology Authority into a deep underground lab. All of our other gold mines that were in the Black Hills are in various stages of reclamation, to include the Brome Mine, which is an EPA Superfund site. I always talk about the Brome Mine because it does pose some special liabilities to the state. As EPA cleans up that mine site, we're liable for a 10% match. So we have to match 10% of everything EPA spends on the cleanup. Probably even more serious is the issue that once EPA completes the cleanup and leaves, then the state is liable for long-term maintenance and care of the site, which is going to include treatment for acid mine drainage, because that's the environmental problem at the site. On slide 9, you can see where they have reclaimed what's called the Ruby Waste Rock Dump. That was reclaimed by covering it with a plastic liner and then bringing in vegetation or topsoil and vegetation on top. The purpose of that liner is to cut off, or not cut off, but at least minimize air and moisture from getting to that rock, because as soon as the moisture touches the rock, that's when it turns to sulfuric acid. And of course, again, that's the environmental issue. You can see the Ruby Waste Rock Dump on slide 10. The green terraced area off to the right is the area that has been reclaimed. All the other colored areas on that map show areas that still need to be reclaimed under the EPA cleanup. EPA has just released its final feasibility study for the site, and they estimate their cleanup cost to be probably more than $50 million. So that's going to be a long-term cleanup, and it's going to take many more years in the future. In terms of other trends in mineral development, if you have an energy mineral, there the trend has been on the increase, and that includes oil, gas, and uranium. You can see on the bottom, or on slide 12, oil production in South Dakota has been increasing. Most of that, of course, is up in the northwest corner of the state in the Harding County area. We also have in the southwest corner of the state our first uranium exploration going on. It's been probably the first permit that we've issued in about 20 to 25 years. Company that's been issued that permit is a company by the name of PowerTech, and they're currently doing exploratory drilling in both Fall River and Custer counties. The last thing that we'll talk a little bit about in terms of land cleanups and so on is spill cleanups. We have about 250 spills reported to us each year. Our job is to try to make sure that the responsible party goes in there and cleans those up to meet state standards so that's protective of public health and the environment. If the responsible party either cannot or will not do the cleanup, then we do have two funds that have been established by the legislature, kind of as provide a safety net when needed. Those two funds are the Regulated Substance Response Fund and the Environmental Livestock Cleanup Fund. If you go to slide 15, simply shows you a typical spill that might be reported to us, a truck overturned. If you look at slide 16, you'll see that historically, about 94% of the spills have been cleaned up and closed out, and we're very proud of that statistic. We think that that shows a very high level of protection, again, of public health and the environment. Now, switching from land protection to water protection, DENR operates programs to protect both ground and surface waters, and we do that in terms of both water quality and water quantity. If you look at the maps on the next two pages, slides 19 through 22, those simply show you the monitoring networks that we operate to make sure that we have data on long-term trends of both water quality and water quantity. For example, slide 19 shows our shallow groundwater quality monitoring network. Slide 20 shows our what we call our observation well network, where we track water levels in aquifers. Slide 21 shows our surface water quality monitoring network. And slide 22 shows our stream gauging network, which we actually contract out on a cost-share basis with the United States Geological Survey to operate. What does all that data tell us that we gather basically on a daily basis? Well, in terms of surface water quantity, we have almost 10,000 miles of streams in South Dakota. But on the downside of that is 80% of those can be intermittent. Consequently, really the only large, reliable supply of surface water that we have in South Dakota is the Missouri River. In terms of surface water quality, our quality is usually pretty good. We meet the standards usually for fish and wildlife. The water quality problems that we do have in this state are excessive sedimentation, excessive fecal coliform levels, and excessive nutrients, which are like phosphorus and nitrogen, especially in our shallow lakes, East River. In terms of groundwater quantity, our surface aquifers fluctuate widely depending upon precipitation, but mostly we're in pretty good shape groundwater quantity-wise where there is groundwater. We have only three aquifers in the state that have been considered fully appropriated, meaning we can issue no more water right permits from those three aquifers, and those are located in Beetle and Spink counties. In terms of groundwater quality, our shallow aquifers are pretty good. Our deeper aquifers, of course, have mineralization in them and are not so good quality. I think the good news is we're seeing no increasing trend in our shallow aquifers and nitrogen levels, but we do have some nitrogen in those waters, but we don't see an increasing trend. The other good piece of news is that we see few detectable levels of pesticides. We simply don't have a pesticide issue, at least that we've seen, according to our data, with our groundwater in South Dakota. What do we do to protect that water quality? Well, we have issued over 4,000 discharge permits in the state, and that includes what we call our concentrated animal feeding operations. Those are feedlots like that are over 1,000 head. We've issued, there are covered 379 concentrated animal feeding operations. Those have all gone through the process to design, construct, and are now operating approved manure management systems and approved nutrient management systems. So we're very, very proud of that accomplishment and being able to work with the agricultural industry to get that done. We also complete total maximum daily loads on surface waters that don't consistently meet standards. That's a requirement of the Federal Clean Water Act. If we don't do that, environmental groups have sued us in the past. I think it was 1982. And so that's something that we don't want to reoccur, and so we need to stay on top of completing our total maximum daily loads to show where there's water quality problems and how do you rectify those. And finally, we provide financial assistance to water quality improvement projects both through the governor's omnibus funding bill, which you see each and every year, and EPA funds. The slide on page 25 shows some of the areas that we have either under assessment or in active water quality improvement projects underway, and you'll see that a fair amount of the state is covered. We also manage water use in South Dakota through the appropriation process as the legislature has established in state law. We have more than 7,000 active water right permits. You'll see on slides 27 and 28 the use of water in South Dakota. Irrigation is very much so the largest user of both surface water and groundwater, followed by municipal and industrial use. In terms of municipal use, most of that is simply for drinking water. The slide on slide 30 shows all the groundwater and surface water intakes used by these public drinking water supplies. We regulate almost about 700 of those systems across the state. The thing that's been changing with regard to drinking water supplies, obviously, is rural water. The slide on slide 31 shows the areas of the state now that are covered or will be covered by rural or regional water systems. Not all of those are completed yet. Perkins, for example, is still under construction. Excuse me. The Miniwichoni has not yet finished up in the Pine Ridge and Rosebud Sioux. The Southern Black Hills is basically still in the design stage. Lewis and Clark, of course, is still under construction, but once completed will serve that whole southeast corner of the state. These rural water systems are making a huge difference. Not only are they bringing a reliable and high-quality supply of water to areas that never had it before, but they're definitely improving both the quality of life, and once that rural water is available, definitely provides the foundation for future economic growth. So that'll continue to be a high priority for the department. Now we switch from water a little bit to air. And the slide on page 33 shows that we're one of only 13 states in the country that completely meet all the federal clean air quality standards. You might ask, well, how do you know that? Well, just like with water, we operate an air quality monitoring network. That network is shown on slide 35, and slide 36 shows what a typical monitoring station might look like. Most of these are on top of roofs, such as this one at the Rapid City Library. How do we protect that air quality and make sure that we continue to meet those federal air quality standards? Well, again, we issue permits. We have over 600 sources of air pollution permitted in South Dakota. The recent focus has definitely been on energy projects. Two, 3 years ago, ethanol was the big expansion area. The slide on 39 shows where all the ethanol plants that we've permitted and are currently in operation are located at. We've currently got a push on with coal-fired power plants. For example, we have an application from Basin Electric to build a 700-megawatt plant up north of Pier here near Selby, and we're currently working on that application. Last year, we spent a lot of time working on the Big Stone 2 air permit application. This will be a plant sitting right next to Big Stone 1 near Millbank. The timeline that we've spent on Big Stone 2 is shown on slide 42. You'll see in January of 2008, we public noticed the draft air quality permit. By April, we had responded to all the public comments we had received and made our final agency permit decisions. In May, the Sierra Club and Clean Water Action contested the permit. On July 16th and 17th, the Board of Minerals and the Environment, which is the final permit issuing authority, toured Big Stone 1 and held a public input meeting in Millbank. Then in August 18, 20, and 21, they began the contested case hearing. They continued the hearing on August 26th. The hearing was still continued with additional testimony from all the parties on September 24th and 25th and 26th. Finally, on November 20th, they heard closing arguments from all parties, and the board unanimously approved the permit. So as far as the administrative process, that's completed. However, you will note on December 18th, the Sierra Club and Clean Water Action filed a notice of appeal in the 6th Judicial Circuit Court. So now that permitting decision will move to the circuit court to see the final outcome. Another big energy project that we worked a lot on this last year is the Hyperion Energy Center. This is a 400,000 barrel per day proposed refinery in Union County. It also will include what's called an IGCC power plant, where they'll supply about 80% of the power that they need to operate the refinery. You can see the timeline on slide 40. On December 20th, they submitted their air permit application to us. On February 20th, we determined the application was complete. On September 10th, we public noticed the draft permit for the facility. On October 7th, we extended the public comment period another 31 days at the request of several individuals and different parties that had submitted comments. On December 17th, we responded into all the comments that we received and mailed back some type of a response. We received comments from more than 3,000 people, organizations, and entities. On January 12th, the Sierra Club, Save Union County, and Citizens Opposed to Oil Pollution petitioned to oppose the permit. Once again, this will go in front of the Board of Minerals and the Environment. The board has already decided that during April, they will make hold a board meeting down in Union County where they'll tour the site and hold a public input meeting in Elk Point. Then their contested case hearings are likely to begin probably this summer and probably conclude this fall. In summary, I hope we've given you a picture that South Dakota, we're very fortunate here in this state because we believe we enjoy a very high quality environment. The Department of Environment and Natural Resources, DENR, works hard to maintain every day that high quality environment, but we also do that with an eye of making sure we're maintaining a good business climate, because if people are going to live here to enjoy our high quality environment, they also need to be able to live, work, and raise their families here. In terms of future challenges, we've quickly listed some of those on slide 46. Lack of water in this state, we're trying to address that by both managing the water resources we have so that we can make the fullest and most beneficial use of the water we do have, plus the expansion of rural water systems. Upgrading water, wastewater, and solid waste facilities in our communities, that's an ongoing process. Timely environmental permitting, that goes along with making sure, trying to enhance our business climate. Total maximum daily loads I talked about, which is a requirement of the Federal Clean Water Act, and that is going to be a continuing activity. And then EPA is all, and Congress are always changing the federal acts. And so there's always changes in the pipeline that we need to react to, and that'll be a continuing priority for us as well. Now, Mr. Chairman, you asked what bills we would be bringing to this legislative session. On slide 47, we talk about three of those bills. Senate Bill 22 would allow counties to borrow for solid waste facilities. Currently, we have three counties that own and operate these regional landfills we talked about, which is Brown County, Walworth County, and Roberts County. In the past, when they've come to us for financial assistance because of the state law, we've only been able to give them a grant and not a loan. We would like to be able to give them a loan through our solid waste funding programs, and so Senate Bill 22, if that's passed by the legislature, would allow us to give them both a combination of grants and loans. Senate Bill 40 would increase the cap on what we call the mining spill bond. In state statute, there's a law that says if you're a mining company and if you have solutions that possibly could spill, create a spill. We can have the authority to put a bond on that to cover that potential spill up to $500,000. Wharf Resources, which is the gold mining company that's still in operation, is bumped up against that $500,000 cap, mostly just because of inflation. We update that bond through the Board of Minerals and the Environment every year and looking at the Consumer Price Index. They bumped against the cap, and so we're going to ask the legislature to increase that cap from $500,000 to $1 million. The third bill that we will be bringing to you through the governor's office is the governor's 2009 Omnibus Water Funding Bill. The slide on 48 is a chart that we give to the Appropriations Committee each year when we present that bill to them. There is no general funds usually in the water bill, and this year there will not be any general funds. It's all what we call dedicated water funding, which is depicted on that chart on slide 48. So that bill will basically estimate the next year's revenues into the Water Environment Fund and will appropriate out that money on a project-by-project and a program-by-program basis. In terms of our budget, The budget request that the governor originally submitted to the legislature reduced DNR's operating budget by $413,654. You can see on slide 49 that our FTE levels, we haven't seen a lot of growth. We've been holding our own pretty much for the last, ever since really about 97 or so. So the FTE growth, the department has not grown much. That $413,000 general fund reduction, the governor did allow us to go and basically come to the legislature to ask to replace that money with fees. So House Bill 1048 has been introduced. That increases essentially five fees, as shown on slide 50. We're proposing to increase the administrative fee to the Water and the Environment Fund for administrative purposes. That allows, under current law, we get $400,000 or the interest, whichever is less. And we're asking to raise that $400,000 to $500,000 because the interest has increased over the years. The solid waste tipping fee, currently that's basically a for every ton of municipal garbage that's dumped at a regional landfill. Currently, they pay in a dollar per ton. We're asking to increase that to $1.25 per ton. The dollar right now goes into a funding program for landfills and recycling projects. The 25 cents that we're asking to add on would come back to the department to help us operate our regulatory program. Sand and gravel license fee, currently, if you have a sand and gravel operator and he gets a license, it's $100 per year. We're proposing to increase that to $100 per pit per year. So if you're an operator and you only have one pit, your fee would remain the same. If you have three pits, your fee would increase to $300 per year. We're also proposing a new fee or an increased fee on large-scale gold, coal, or uranium mines. Right now, the application fee is $1,000, and then it's $100 per year permit fee. We're proposing to raise both those fees to $50,000, and this would be only on new large-scale mines. The reason we think is simply because any new large-scale mine always is controversial. Always we spend a lot of time, money, and resources getting it through the application process, the permitting process, and then there's always a lot of inspections and follow-up to do. And we think $50,000 would be a reasonable fee for a new large-scale mine. This would not impact our existing large-scale mines, the way the legislation is drafted right now. And then finally, water right fees. We have a lot of different fees in statute for filing of water rights and different notices. We're proposing to increase those. Most of those were set in the 1970s and 80s and haven't been increased since. And so we think that those fees are warranted as well. Mr. Chairman, that concludes my formal remarks. What I'll try to do is, between myself and our staff that are here, we'll try to answer any questions that you or the committee may have.
Thank you, Secretary Perner. Questions? Representative Cronin.
Yeah, Steve. That next-gen project in Selby, is it true that they just resubmitted their proposal to you guys? When they first submitted it, they were going to set up for clean air, but now they have resubmitted, and the power plant is going to be fully equipped with the clean air products. Is that true?
Mr. Chairman. As far as I know, they submitted us the application, several months ago, and we've determined the application to be complete. If they've submitted us additional information since then, I guess I'm not aware of that, but I can certainly check and get back to you if I learn anything. But I think are you talking maybe like the carbon stuff?
Yes, that'd be correct. I couldn't think of the exact words that. It was going to be set up the first time around. We had a meeting with a planning meeting in Mobridge, and it was going to be set up to where it would be capable of catching all the carbons. I think
correct.
That's correct. I'm sorry. And I had just heard when I was back home this weekend that they were talking about, due to the incoming administration in Washington, they were thinking of resubmitting it, that part.
Okay.
And maybe that, too. I'm sorry to get you confused there.
Well, no, Mr. Chairman, if I might respond. Yeah, the permit application that they gave us did not include carbon, and the reason is because carbon is not a regulated pollutant at this time. If you remember, we've listed on slide somewhere in the clean air section here the what are federally regulated pollutants. There we go. It's on slide 34. That includes what we call PM 2.5. PM stands for particulate matter, which is a very, very fine, like dust particle. PM10, particulate matter, 10 microns or smaller, which is a slightly larger particle. Ozone, sulfur dioxide, and nitrogen dioxide. And so those are the primary things that in their application that they've given us that they're going to have to control. Now, as far as the carbon that you're talking about, you've probably all heard some discussion about global warming and the allegations that that's a result of increased carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere. And whether or not that's true or not, I guess will remain to be seen. But you are right. President-elect Obama has said that controlling carbon emissions, thereby controlling global warming or minimizing it or whatever, will be one of his administration's highest priorities. And so I know Basin Electric is very aware of all the discussion and so on that's been going on revolving around carbon. They also have a pilot project, I can't remember the location, somewhere to try to capture the carbon. And if that pilot works out, I think they'll be prepared to move that technology to the plant up near Selby. But at this point, all that, I think, is in a state of flux. It's going to be dependent on what Congress and the federal administration really, I think, does on a national scale.
I think originally Basin was looking at the clean coal technology, and then since there's no federal tax credits, that kind of got put on the back burner. But the Hyperion project, is that a clean coal technology?
The which one?
The Hyperion project. You stated that they're going to generate 80% of the power that they use.
Roughly.
Is that coal?
No.
No,
that's basically one of their byproducts.
Really?
Through the refinery. The coke is what they're proposing to use in that power plant, and whether or not then they'll supplement that with another fuel source or not, I guess I don't know at this point. But they're proposing to try to include what's called IGCC, and I can never remember what all that stands for, but basically what it allows them to do is capture the carbon from the emissions and then, you know, what do you do with it? But you know, the thought right now is most of one of the most feasible methods of storing carbon is to inject it deep underground. Whether or not that can work anywhere and everywhere, I think remains to be seen. EPA is currently in a very preliminary rulemaking process on whether or not you can inject carbon underground and not, you know, impact groundwater and things like that. So I think we're just going to have to see how that technology evolves.
I think when you look at environmental matters as far as coal-fired power plants, the last 20 years will be referred to as the good old days.
Could be.
I see a lot of attitude, not just in the incoming administration, but a lot of, you know, in the Congress that they just don't want to see any new coal-fired power plants, and I hope that when I'm old and on a respirator, I don't have it powered by a wind turbine. So, yes, Representative Ruscio.
I hope you aren't either. Being representing Fall River County, you know what I'm going to zero in on? $50,000 for a permit for uranium mining. Will that affect the in-situ operation at PowerTech, or are they considered already underway?
Mr. Chairman, the way the bill is drafted currently is if they submit the application, basically if the legislature passes House Bill 1048, it would become effective on July 1. That's the effective date of bills that are passed. So if this bill were to be passed and they submit their permit application prior to July 1, they would probably not have to pay that $50,000 application fee. But if they receive a permit, then they would still have to pay the $50,000 annual permit fee. Now, having said that, you'll also, if you read House Bill 1048, you'll see that there's provisions in there that Energy Minerals currently pay what's called a conservation tax, which it comes back to the department to help fund its regulatory programs. And so what we've done in the bill, when we talked to PowerTech about this $50,000 fee, they said, well, we'd already be paying the conservation tax. Well, we said, okay, that's already in statute. Basically, we'll give you a credit up to $50,000 for the conservation tax. So in other words, if they go into production and they extract enough uranium to pay, let's say, $60,000, then they wouldn't have to pay this $50,000 fee. But if they're only paying in, like, let's say, $20,000 of the conservation tax, then they would have to make up that other $30,000. So that's the way the bill is designed in its current form.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, sir. Representative Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm a representative in District 23, and we have a lot of irrigation going on in that district. At this time, I have a patron who's in litigation with a neighbor of his, decisively trying to decide whether or not that neighbor's irrigation is creating a dismal level in his wells, not being able to carry on livestock watering. To date, you have stayed kind of neutral in that and looking at all the issues, and I'm not sure the lady who's in charge of that. I don't know how the process works. He's very upset. He's relaying that to me. I called the Attorney General's office. And the way state government works, I guess, is that every department has an attorney delivered to them or working for them from the Attorney General office. So that would be a conflict of interest for them to give out information to me to give back to my client. I think he's hired an attorney, Tom Tobin from Aberdeen. I told him to go hire Bill Janklo. Maybe he understands the system. And I'm not pointing fingers, but this is a serious issue because if the gentleman runs out of water for his livestock, he's out of business. In your best estimation for him, what in past cases has worked well in cases like this for a gentleman to get a court order stopping someone else from putting in a brand new well? He's not shutting down the other wells. He just doesn't want the next well going in, which he thinks will be the death, the dagger in the final say of his wells. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, do you know, has he appeared in front of the Water Management Board? And so the board has made a ruling probably that he is not being impacted or that his well is what we call an inadequate well. Do you know which the case was?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What he has told me is that they have not found conclusive data or evidence that this irrigation well is creating enough of a hardship. The wells so far that they're going to stop his operation from being in business. He's concerned the next well they have planned for next year or 2010 is going to put the last coffin nail down on the lid and shut him up. And I have seen in my own area when they kick in, six irrigation wells, our dugouts, being we're all level with the Spring Creek aquifer up there just south of the border, they all start dropping. And when they quit irrigating in the fall, all our dugouts, I had water running on top of ice in some dugouts as that water level comes back up. Now, I think there were springs running this year. It was really weird. The Long Lake was open, in spots. At least two fishermen found out the hard way by going 8 inches on shore, 2 inches out, and they're lucky the neighbor was home. They both would be dead today because he got them out of there. But anyway, that case of the gentleman in my district is ongoing, and I need to contact him and find out. But the only thing that really bothers me is that when I come to Pier, I call Pier and go talk to the Attorney General's office. They can't give me any information on how to best fight this because they're working for you, and you're also the person that has to give the final say whether you can cut that other well off. So there's a little bit of a conflict of interest, and that's why I told him to go find Bill Janklow. If anybody in the state understands the process in Pier, he should. Thank you.
Well, Mr. Chairman, first of all, let me say that any time that somebody applies, like for that irrigation well, he needs what's called a water right permit, which we talked about in our presentation. All of those permits are public noticed. Make sure that people in that local area know about it and have the opportunity to essentially contest that application. And again, the entity that makes those final decisions is what we call the Water Management Board. Those are a citizen-appointed board who routinely hears these matters. And the issues that they hear are exactly what you're describing. If I'm an adjoining landowner and I think this new application is going to impact me, I certainly have the right to come in front of the board and explain that and the reasons why I think that happens. So if that permit was contested and it was still issued by the board, then you're right. The recourse is to go to circuit court because the administrative process once again has been completed. Now, a lot of times what happens is the board is trying to determine whether or not, again, if I have the existing well, is my well adequate? Because I don't know how to explain this real easy, but let's say I got a 100-foot aquifer, and if my well extends only 20 foot into that aquifer, then there's a whole lot of water. There's 80 foot of saturated material underneath me that can be developed. And so if my neighbor comes in with his irrigation well and puts in his irrigation well at 80 foot deep, it could have an impact on my 20-foot well. Now, what the board will, and I never speak for boards because they do what they do, but typically they will say I have an inadequate well. What I need to do then is go and make my well deeper, down to 80 foot or whatever, so that irrigation well no longer is having an impact on me. And that's where we get into a lot of these disputes, because if I'm a typical landowner, I'll say, but I've been here 60 years, that well 60 years old. Why do I have to go make my well any deeper? If the board doesn't decide that way, though, then essentially what you're doing is limiting development, because you've got all that water available below my 20-foot well that no one else can develop. See? So essentially what the board's trying to do is determine, is water available? That's one of the statutory tests that they have to answer in this hearing. And then they have to ask, is unappropriated water available? And they have to ask, are we going to impact senior water rights? So they have to answer these questions in a very logical manner. But that's why that's just one of the main reasons why people come away dissatisfied from those hearings. Because if they are told that there's water available and it's simply their well is inadequate to pump the quantity that they're looking for, and they have to go back and rehab the well, that isn't a lot of times what they want to hear.
Good answer. That makes a lot of sense. I appreciate that. Who was over here? Representative Van Gerp.
Thank you for that information. I would like to draw your attention to slide number 23, where it says the groundwater quality. You indicate there's no increasing trend in the nitrogen levels and few detectable levels of pesticide, and that's really encouraging to see that report. And I'm just curious, do you see anything on the horizon in terms of farming practices, till or no-till, that will change that? Or are we doing well now, and as long as we don't increase our fertilizer input significantly, we should stay pretty good shape with regards to the water quality? Or does the soil absorb these nitrates and then they build up, or are they continuously flowing through the soil? Could you comment on that, please?
Mr. Chairman, to answer the first part first, where we say no increasing trend in nitrogen levels, typically about 20% of our samples from shallow aquifers will probably violate the nitrate standard for groundwater, which is 10 parts per million. So that's kind of the bad news. Now, the good news is we aren't seeing an increasing trend. And the network that we specifically use is the one that's shown on slide 19. That's what we call our shallow groundwater quality monitoring network. The reason why that was established and why we maintain that monitoring network is try to look at exactly the question that you're asking. Are there trends going on in agriculture that are going to impact our groundwater quality? So far, the data from this network is pretty well summarized on that slide. We aren't seeing, I mean, the really good news is on pesticides. And that was one, if you, for example, Iowa. Iowa does have problems with pesticides in groundwater. I think part of the reason why we haven't seen issues in the past is we have a lot less precipitation in the state, and we farm not nearly as hard as, for example, Iowa. Now, whether or not that's going to change over time, I think that's the reason why we've established the network, is to try to monitor those long-term trends. And if we start seeing a trend one way or the other, then it's going to be time to, you know, go to SDSU or wherever the ag groups and say, what do we need to do about this? But at this point in time, the data that we're seeing really doesn't show any problems that we're really, really worried about at this point. And in the future, don't know.
Somebody over here had a question. Representative Sly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My first question is on slide 50 in regard to the mining, the fees, permit fees. Is that $50,000 a one-time fee, or is that per year?
Mr. Chairman, basically there's I've tried to keep the slide short, so there's really two fees. There's an application fee to when they submit the application to get the permit. That's a one-time fee. And then the way the bill is structured, there's an annual permit fee. And that is also then a $50,000 fee, according to the bill, per year.
Per year. Okay, thank you. And my second question has to do
if they get the permit.
With the Southern Black Hills rural water system that's going in, what is the source of water? Is it well or surface?
Mr. Chairman, at this point in time, I think they're still looking at groundwater, at a well. They've tried to enter into, I think, a contract, if I remember correctly, with the what's called the Streeter well. Does that sound right? I think that's right. Is that right? Yeah. Yeah, George back here, he's been working with them on a daily basis from rural water. So that's where they're currently focused. And then I think if the system gets underway, they're going to need additional water sources, and that I think they're still looking. But for now, it's groundwater.
Thank you.
Yeah, people have been looking for water sources in the Southern Hills for a long time. Finding them either. Representative Sorensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Three quick questions and a longer one. We can wait for another day if we run out of time. But on page 6, the slide there, mineral development, there's 1,886 licensed sand and gravel sites. Mine's one of those, and I've got a question. The contractor, neighbor, gentleman's agreement type thing, he ups and dies. for the gravel. The gravel's in a pile. The pit's not reclaimed. Is he bonded that is there money set aside that if he's deceased that pit will be reclaimed?
Mr. Chairman, yes. If you're a licensed sand and gravel operator, you have to put up a bond. It's limited by state law. I think it's either $500 per acre or $20,000 statewide. So basically he's going to take whichever is the less of those two amounts, and that's what he will be bonded for.
Okay. Second question. Thank you. Second question, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Spill cleanups, slide 14. About 250, about 250 per year. Neighbor rolls over a sprayer. Now, this didn't happen, but neighbor rolls over a sprayer. He gets that spray out of that ditch as quick as he can. I'm safe to guess that there's a certain percentage that probably aren't reported. These are the ones that are reported. In your estimation, do we need to do a better job as neighbors and all of us helping you guys enforce this? How many are not enforced or turned in spills?
All of them.
yeah, Mr. Chairman.
What's that neighbor's name?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, the ones that aren't turned in, usually we don't, probably you're right, we probably don't know about.
No, you don't know.
There have been instances, though, like, for example, I think it was in Union County, where alongside the interstate, it was reported to us that there was these large dead areas, just devoid of vegetation. And so we did an investigation and working with public safety, and we finally found where there was a trucker coming over from Iowa, and I don't even remember what he was carrying, some kind of fertilizer, I think. I can't even remember. But anyway, he was basically overweight, and before he'd hit the weigh station, he'd dump in this spot. So we were able to finally catch him, and I think that resulted in a criminal conviction. So those kind of things, if people turn them in to us, we can sometimes find them. Other times, then we can't. It just depends.
And that leads to the second part of the question. I would hope that if there's negligence and there is a spill and somebody does not report it, I would hope that we'd have laws in the books to prosecute for not turning it in. Am I correct?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. We have both authorities for criminal and civil penalties. Typically, we pursue civil penalties because there the burden of proof is much less. If you're going to go for a criminal conviction, obviously the burden of proof is much higher. And so we do have both authorities in state law. Our maximum civil penalty that we can collect per day, I think, is like $10,000 per day.
Thank you. And the last question, the concentrated livestock sites and they go through quite a rigorous test before, with well water and, underground water and so forth. Are those tested yearly? Is the water around those tested yearly?
Mr. Chairman, there's rules that determine the inspection frequency on our part. It's based on the number of head. Some of those inspections are every 3 years, some are every 2 years, and some are every year, depending on the size of the operation. Now, if you're talking about a site that has been required, not all sites do, but if groundwater is a concern, we do make those operations put in groundwater monitoring wells. And those then are monitored by the operator. Usually, it just depends, somewhere between a quarterly and annual basis with the reports then submitted to us. But and then I should also mention permitted operations also have to do a number of other inspections. They have to keep a log of those inspections. So there is all that kind of record keeping that goes along with that general permit.
Thank you.
Other questions?
I guess if we have time, the bigger question, and you know, is, and maybe it is a simple question. We've been told, and we've been observing for the last 10, 15 years, people predict that by the year, you know, 2050 or 2100, when hopefully our children and grandchildren are still inhabiting this earth, that water, the availability of fresh water, probably will be more important. We'll be fighting over that more than we will oil. Do you foresee that in the future, fresh water and the availability of it will be that big of an issue?
Mr. Chairman, the I think in South Dakota, water availability has been an issue for quite some time. Again, if you go back and you look at our data, I mentioned that 80% of our streams, I think was the figure, are basically intermittent. Groundwater, again, where we have shallow aquifers, there is good quality water available. Where there's deeper aquifers, that quality isn't near as good, which is the larger, I mean, our shallow aquifers is a relatively small part of the state. So, yeah, so water availability has been an issue in South Dakota. As I said, probably the largest supply of surface water that we have is the Missouri River. That's a reliable supply. And that's why it makes those regional water systems, those rural water systems, so important, is because there we're able to take that reliable, high-quality water, treat it to meet the standards, and then supply it essentially both to urban and rural areas. And that's really, really been an incredibly important, I think, part of improving the quality of life here in South Dakota. Now, in terms of just the global supply of water, I guess I'm not going to comment on that because I don't know enough about that. I can just talk about here in South Dakota. And as long as we got the Missouri River and with those rural water systems, we're going to be in pretty good shape.
Thank you.
Representative Street.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On your DENR fee bill, particularly the $50,000 permit fee and then the ongoing annual fee, are existing mines exempt from the annual fee too?
Mr. Chairman, the way the bill is structured currently, they should be, yes. It should be only to new mines that are permitted after July 1.
Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
So we will have a situation where one set of mines will not be paying a $50,000 fee and a new set will be on an annual ongoing basis.
Mr. Chairman, that would be correct if House Bill 1048 passes the way it is, and that we thought about that issue. Is that fair? I guess the way we resolve that in our minds is for our existing mines, going from $100 to $50,000 per year seemed kind of a steep increase. And so we said, for the new guys, they'll know the rules coming in. For the guys that have been here, our proposal is to maintain the rules as they are for them.
Thank you.
Just a question. last year before, came through this committee and this body granted you rulemaking authority on the in situ mining method of mining, and we've heard a lot from outright opponents of uranium mining to people concerned with groundwater and whatnot. Could you give us a little bit of a overview on what exactly in situ mining is and the concerns? Or how you allay concerns concerning groundwater.
Okay, the in situ mining that you're talking about is, instead of digging a hole to extract the mineral or the ore, what in situ means is it's recovered in place. So essentially, if I have an ore-bearing formation under here, and in this case, let's say it's uranium, it's got uranium in it. What the company is proposing to do, if their exploration thing pans out, data, would be to drill holes inject whatever's needed to put, basically take that uranium and put it in a solution. And then other wells in that complex will be extraction wells where the solution is pumped up to the surface and uranium is removed from the solution. So consequently, we have essentially no disturbance other than the drill holes. So that's what, for example, PowerTech is looking at with at the uranium deposits in Fall River and Custer counties. Now, you're correct that we came to the department. We the price of uranium really spiked. It went from, I don't know what it was, like $10 or $20, $30 a pound up to like $140. And it's fallen back some now. But when it was on that increasing trend, we knew that we have good uranium deposits, especially in that southwest corner of the state. And so we looked at our laws and we looked at our rules and we said, are we prepared to deal with that if and when uranium development comes back to South Dakota? Because we did have some in the 50s and 60s. And that was done before we had any permits, before we had any reclamation requirements. There was no state law basically governing that activity. And most of those sites... are still there. A lot of those are on federal land, especially up in the northwest corner, and so the U.S. Forest Service continues to deal with that old uranium mining. But anyway, we a couple of years ago, we looked at our laws. We said if uranium development comes back to South Dakota, are we ready? We decided that we needed some, close a few gaps, and so we brought, I think it was one bill, I think it was Senate Bill 62, maybe. Does that sound right? To the legislature, you passed that bill, which did a couple of things, one of which authorized us to adopt rules specifically for in situ mining, because we haven't had any of that in South Dakota previous to this. There is some going on in Nebraska. There's a in situ uranium mine in Nebraska operating, and Wyoming has some, I think, in situ mines. Nebraska for sure. So anyway, we went through a lengthy rulemaking process, and actually we did it twice, because what we figured out is that for an in-situ mine, they essentially need two different permits from the state. The first one they need is called an underground injection control permit to basically make sure that the stuff that's being injected down into that formation isn't going to cause problems, essentially, is the purpose of and impact any drinking water supplies. That's the big issue. The underground injection control permit is really a part of the Federal Safe Drinking Water Act. So we went through that rulemaking process, and then we also, which is in front of the Board of Water Management, I should add, and then we also said they need a mine permit, and that's under the Board of Minerals and the Environment. And so we went through rulemaking there as well. And so we've put in place, I think, some pretty comprehensive rules that if this PowerTech proposal does proceed, I think we've got good rules in place to regulate that and do what's needed to make sure that, again, the environment is being protected. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you. Other questions? No other questions? This is your chance.
Well, if there's no other questions, Mr. Chairman, I would simply say that thank you again for giving us the opportunity to appear in front of you. Over in the Department of Environment and Natural Resources, we've got some really, really fine staff. We've got engineers, scientists, hydrologists, geologists, and an excellent support staff. If there's anything that comes up that we can help you with, please feel free to get a hold of us, and we'll do our best to try to get you the answer. Maybe not the answer you want, but at least an answer. With that, thank you very much.
Thank you. And one thing I will say is that I appreciate the fact that when you look at the timeline on some of these permits, as far as power plants, refineries, it's obvious that your department is pro-business. I mean, you don't have it, you're not setting out to stop the stuff, you're setting out to promote business and a good sound economy, and I really appreciate that. I think that speaks well for our state that we don't have a bunch of people running around trying to hold everything up, and we know that time is money to people who come before you, and you have a real appreciation for that, and that's, I appreciate that very much. So is there anything else that needs to come before this committee? We'll start Thursday. Game and Fish will be before us, and they have some bills pre-filed that we will probably take up a few of them. I need to go through the list again and see what we're going to do, but while they're here in our midst, we'll hear some of their bills after we hear an overview from them also. So if there's nothing else coming before this committee, I would entertain a motion to adjourn. Motion by Sly, second by Olson. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed nay. We are adjourned.